ago to do things in this way, to keep officers associated with a single ship for many years, and to give the captain great sway over their careers. This is an operational question, not a political one.
We have already considered that, Narmanov replied. It is true that in this case there is enough blame for more than one man.
Gorshkov didn't move, but the message was explicit. His effort to separate himself from this scandal had failed. Narmanov didn't care how many heads it took to prop up his chair.
Comrade Chairman, Gorshkov objected, the efficiency of the fleet.
Efficiency, Alexandrov said. Efficiency. This Lithuanian half-breed is efficiently making fools of our fleet with his chosen officers, while our remaining ships blunder about like newly castrated cattle.
Alexandrov alluded to his first job on a state farm. A fitting beginning, it was generally thought, for the man who held the position of chief ideologue was as popular in Moscow as the plague. But the Politburo had to have him, or one like him. The ideological chieftain was always the kingmaker. Whose side was he on now, in addition to his own?
The most likely explanation is that Putin was murdered, Podorin continued. He alone of the officers left behind a wife and family.
That's another question, Comrade Admiral. Narmanov seized this issue.
Why is it that none of these men are married? Didn't that tell you something? Must we of the Politburo supervise everything? Can't you think for yourselves?
As if you want us to, Podorin thought.
Comrade General Secretary, most of our submarine commanders prefer young, unmarried officers in their wardrooms. Duty at sea is demanding, and single men have fewer distractions. Moreover, each of the senior officers aboard is a party member, in good standing with a praiseworthy record. Ramius has been treacherous, there's no denying that, and I would gladly kill the son of a bitch with my own hands. But he has deceived more good men than there are in this room.
Indeed, Alexandrov observed. And now that we are in this mess, how do we get out of it? Podorin took a deep breath. He'd been waiting for this.
Comrades, we have another man aboard the Red October, unknown to either Putin or Captain Ramius, an agent of the main political administration.
What? Gorshkov said.
And why did I not know of this?
Alexandrov smiled.
That's the first intelligent thing we've heard today.
Go on.
This individual is covered as an enlisted man. He reports directly to our office, bypassing all operational and political channels. His name is Igor Loginov. He is 24.
24? Narmanov shouted.
You trust a child with this responsibility?
Comrade, Loginov's mission is to blend in with the conscripted crewmen, to listen in on conversations, to identify likely traitors, spies, and saboteurs. In truth, he looks younger still. He serves alongside young men, and he must be young himself. He is, in fact, a graduate of the Higher Naval School for Political Officers at Kiev and the GRU Intelligence Academy. He is the son of Arkady Ivanovich Loginov, chief of the Lenin steel plant at Kazan. Many of you here know his father. Narmanov was among those who nodded, a flickering of interest in his eyes.
Only an elite few are chosen for this duty. I have met and interviewed this boy myself. His record is clear. He is a Soviet patriot, without question.
I know his father, Narmanov confirmed.
Arkady Ivanovich is an honorable man who has raised several good sons.
What are this boy's orders?
As I said, Comrade General Secretary, his ordinary duties are to observe the crewman and report on what he sees. He's been doing this for 2 years, and he is good at it. He does not report to the Zampolit aboard, but only to Moscow, or to one of my representatives. In a genuine emergency, his orders are report to the Zampolit. If Putin is alive, and I do not believe this, comrades, he would be part of the conspiracy, and Loginov would know not to do this. In a true emergency, therefore, his orders are to destroy the ship and make his escape.
This is possible? Narmanov asked. Gorshkov?
Comrades, all of our ships carry powerful scuttling charges, submarines especially.
Unfortunately, Padorin said, these are generally not armed, and only the captain can activate them. Ever since the incident on the Storezhevoy, we, in the main political administration, have had to consider that an incident such as this one was indeed a possibility, and that its most damaging manifestation would involve a missile-carrying submarine.
Ah, Narmanov observed. He is a missile mechanic.
No, comrade. He is a ship's cook, Padorin replied.
Wonderful! He spends all his day boiling potatoes.
Narmanov's hands flew up in the air, his hopeful demeanor gone in an instant, replaced with palpable wrath.
You wish your bullet now, Padorin.
Comrade Chairman, this is a better cover assignment than you may imagine.
Padorin did not flinch, wanting to show these men what he was made of.
On Red October, the officers' accommodations and gallery are aft. The crew's quarters are forward. The crew eat there since they do not have a separate mess room with the missile room in between. As a cook, he must travel back and forth many times a day, and his presence in any particular area would not be thought unusual.
The food freezer is located adjacent to the lower missile deck, forward.
It is not our plan that he should activate the scuttling charges. We have allowed for the possibility that the captain could disarm them.
Comrades, these measures have been carefully thought out.
Go on, Narmanov grunted.
As Comrade Gorshkov explained earlier, Red October carried 26 Seahawk missiles. These are solid fuel rockets, and one had a range safety package installed.
Range safety? Narmanov was puzzled. Up to this point, the military officers at the meeting, none of them Politburo members, had kept their peace. Padorin was surprised when General V.M. Vyshenkov, commander of the Strategic Rocket Forces, spoke up.
Comrades, these details were worked out through my office some years ago. As you know, when we test our missiles, we have safety packages aboard to explode them if they go off course. Otherwise, they might land on one of our own cities. Our operational missiles do not ordinarily carry them. For the obvious reasons, the Imperialist might learn a way to explode them in flight.
So, our young GRU comrade will blow up the missile.
What of the warheads?
Narmanov asked. An engineer by training, he could always be distracted by a technical discourse, always impressed by a clever one.
Comrade, Vyshenkov went on, the missile warheads are armed by accelerometers. Thus, they cannot be armed until the missile reaches its full programmed speed. The Americans use the same system, and for the same reason, to prevent sabotage. These safety systems are absolutely reliable. You could drop one of the re-entry vehicles from the top of Moscow television transmitter onto a steel plate, and it would not fire.
The general referred to the massive TV tower whose construction Narmanov had personally supervised while head of the Central Communications Directorate. Vyshenkov was a skilled political operator.
In the case of a solid-fuel rocket, Padorin continued, recognizing his debt to Vyshenkov, wondering what he'd ask for in return, and hoping he'd live long enough to deliver. A safety package ignites all of the missile's three stages simultaneously.
So the missile just takes off? Alexandrov asked.
No, comrade academician. The upper stage might. If it could break through the missile tube hatch, and this would flood the missile room, sinking the submarine. But even if it did not, there is sufficient thermal energy in either of the first stages to reduce the entire submarine to a puddle of molten iron, 20 times what is necessary to sink it. Loginov has been trained to bypass the alarm system on the missile tube hatch, to activate the safety package, set a timer, and escape.
Not just to destroy the ship, Narmanov asked.
Comrade General Secretary, Padorin said. It is too much to ask a young man to do his duty, knowing that it means certain death. We would be unrealistic to expect this. He must have at least the possibility of escape, Otherwise, human weakness might lead to failure.
This is reasonable, Alexandrov said. Young men are motivated by hope, not fear. In this case, young Loginov would hope for a considerable reward.
And get it, Narmanov said. We will make every effort to save this young man, Gorshkov.
If he is truly reliable, Alexandrov noted.
I know that my life depends on this, comrade academician, Podorin said, his back still straight. He did not get a verbal answer, only nods from half the heads at the table. He had faced death before, and was at the age where it remains the last thing a man need face.
The White House. Arbatov came into the Oval Office at 4:50 p.m. He found the President and Dr. Pelt sitting in easy chairs across from the Chief Executive's desk.
Come on over, Alex. Coffee?
The President pointed to a tray on the corner of his desk. He was not drinking today, Arbatov noted.
No, thank you, Mr. President. May I ask?
We think we found your sub, Alex, Pelt answered. They just brought these dispatches over, and we're checking them now.
The advisor held up a ring binder of message forms.
Where is it, may I ask? The ambassador's face was deadpan.
Roughly 300 miles northeast of Norfolk. We have not located it exactly. One of our ships noted an underwater explosion in the area. No, that's not right. It was recorded on a ship, and when the tapes were checked a few hours later, they thought they heard a submarine explode and sink. Sorry, Alex, Pelt said. I should have known better than to read through all this stuff without an interpreter.
Does your Navy talk in its own language, too?
Officers do not like for civilians to understand them, Arbatov smiled. This has doubtless been true since the first man picked up his stone. Anyway, we have ships and aircraft searching the area now.
The President looked up. Alex, I talked to the Chief of Naval Operations, Dan Foster, a few minutes ago. He said not to expect any survivors. The water there is 1,000 feet deep, and you know what the weather is like. They said it's right on the edge of the continental shelf.
The Norfolk Canyon, sir, Pelt added.
We are conducting a thorough search, the President continued. The Navy is bringing in some specialized rescue equipment, search gear, all that sort of thing. If the submarine is located, we'll get somebody down to them on the chance there might be survivors. From what the CNO tells me, it is just possible that there might be if the interior partitions, bulkheads I think he called them, are intact. The other question is their air supply, he said. Time is very much against us, I'm afraid. All this fantastically expensive equipment we buy them, and they can't locate one damned object right off our coast.
Arbatov made a mental record of these words. It would make a worthwhile intelligence report. The President occasionally let...
By the way, Mr. Ambassador, what exactly was your submarine doing there?
I have no idea, Dr. Pelt.
I trust it was not a missile sub, Pelt said. We have an agreement to keep those 500 miles offshore. The wreck will, of course, be inspected by our rescue craft. Were we to learn that it is indeed a missile sub?
Your point is noted. Still, those are international waters.
The President turned and spoke softly.
So is the Gulf of Finland, Alex, and, I believe, the Black Sea.
He let this observation hang in the air for a moment. I sincerely hope that we are not heading back to that kind of situation. Are we talking about a missile submarine, Alex?
Truly, Mr. President, I have no idea. Certainly, I should hope not.
The President could see how carefully the lie was phrased. He wondered if the Russians would admit that there was a captain out there who had disregarded his orders. No, they would probably claim a navigation error.
Very well. In any case, we will be conducting our own search and rescue operation. We'll know soon enough what sort of vessel we're talking about.
The President looked suddenly uneasy.
One more thing Foster talked about. If we find bodies, pardon the crudity on a Saturday afternoon, I expect that you will want them returned to your country?
I have had no instructions on this, the ambassador answered truthfully, caught off guard.
It was explained to me in too much detail what a death like this does to a man. In simple terms, they're crushed by the water pressure. Not a very pretty thing to see, they tell me. But they were men, and they deserve some dignity, even in death. Arbatov conceded the point. If this is possible, then I believe that the Soviet people would appreciate this humanitarian gesture. We'll do our best. And the American best, Arbatov remembered, included a ship named the Glomar Explorer. This notorious exploration ship had been built by the CIA for the specific purpose of recovering a Soviet Gulf-class missile submarine from the floor of the Pacific Ocean. She had been placed in storage, no doubt to await the next such opportunity. There would be nothing the Soviet Union could do to prevent the operation, a few hundred miles off the American coast, 300 miles from the United States' largest naval base. I trust that the precepts of international law will be observed, gentlemen, that is, with respect to the vessel's remains and the crew's bodies. Of course, Alex, the president smiled, gesturing to a memorandum on his desk. Arbatov struggled for control. He'd been led down this path like a schoolboy, forgetting that the American president had been a skilled courtroom tactician, not something that life in the Soviet Union prepares a man for, and knew all about legal tricks. Why was this bastard so easy to underestimate? The president was also struggling to control himself. It was not often that he saw Alex flustered. This was a clever opponent, not easily caught off balance. Laughing would spoil it. The memorandum from the Attorney General had arrived only that morning. It read, Mr. President, pursuant to your request, I have asked the Chief of our Admiralty Law Department to review the question of international law regarding the ownership of sunken or derelict vessels, and the law of salvage pertaining to such vessels. There is a good deal of case law on the subject. One simple example is Dalmas versus Stathos. It says, no problem of foreign law is here involved, for it is well settled that salvage is a question arising out of the jus gentium and does not ordinarily depend on the municipal law of particular countries. The international basis for this is the Salvage Convention of 1910, Brussels, which codified the transnational nature of admiralty and salvage law. This was ratified by the United States in the Salvage Act of 1912. International law will be observed, Alex, the president promised, in all particulars. And whatever we get, he thought, will be taken to the nearest port, Norfolk, where it will be turned over to the receiver of wrecks, an overworked federal official. If the Soviets want anything back, they can bring action in Admiralty Court, which means the Federal District Court sitting in Norfolk, where, if the suit were successful, after the value of the salved property was determined, and after the U.S. Navy was paid a proper fee for its salvage effort, also determined by the court, the wreck would be returned to its rightful owners. Of course, the Federal District Court in question had, at last check, an 11-month backlog of cases. Arbatov would cable Moscow on this. For what good it would do. He was certain the president would take perverse pleasure in manipulating the grotesque American legal system to his own advantage, all the time pointing out that, as president, he was constitutionally unable to interfere with the working of the courts. Pelt looked at his watch. It was about time for the next surprise. He had to admire the president. For a man with only limited knowledge of international affairs, only a few years earlier, he'd learned fast. This outwardly simple, quiet-talking man was at his best in face-to-face situations, and after a lifetime's experience as a prosecutor, he still loved to play the game of negotiation and tactical exchange. He seemed able to manipulate people with frighteningly casual skill. The phone rang, and Pelt got it, right on cue.
This is Dr. Pelt speaking. Yes, Admiral.
Where?
When?
Just one?
I see. Norfolk? Thank you, Admiral. That is very good news. I will inform the President immediately. Please keep us advised.
Pelt turned around.
We got one. Alive, by God!
A survivor of the lost sub? The president stood. Well, he's a Russian sailor. A helicopter picked him up an hour ago, and they're flying him to the Norfolk Base Hospital. They picked him up 290 miles northeast of Norfolk, so I guess that makes it fit. The men on the ship say he's in pretty bad shape, but the hospital is ready for him. The president walked to his desk and lifted the phone. Grace, ring me Dan Foster right now. Admiral, this is the president. The man they picked up. How soon to Norfolk? Another 2 hours? He grimaced. Admiral, you get on the phone to the Naval Hospital and you tell them that I say they are to do everything they can for that man. I want him treated like he was my own son. Is that clear? Good. I want hourly reports on his condition. I want the best people we have in on this. The very best. Thank you, Admiral. He hung up.
All right. Maybe we were too pessimistic, Alex, Pelt chirped up.
Will we be allowed to see our men? Arbatov asked at once.
Certainly, the president answered. You have a doctor at the embassy, don't you?
Yes, we do, Mr. President.
Take him down, too. He'll be extended every courtesy. I'll see to that. Jeff, are they searching for other survivors?
Yes, Mr. President. There's a dozen aircraft in the area right now, and two more ships on the way.
Good. The president clapped his hands together, enthusiastic as a kid in a toy store. Now, if we can find some more survivors, maybe we can give your country a meaningful Christmas present, Alex. We will do everything we can. You have my word on that.
That is very kind of you, Mr. President. I will communicate this happy news to my country at once.
Not so fast, Alex. The chief executive held his hand up. I'd say this calls for a drink. The 10th day. Sunday, 12th December. Sosus Control. At Sosus Control in Norfolk, the picture was becoming increasingly difficult. The United States simply did not have the technology to keep track of submarines in the deep ocean basins. The Sosus receptors were principally laid at shallow water choke points on the bottom of undersea ridges and highlands. The strategy of the NATO countries was a direct consequence of this technological limitation. In a major war with the Soviets, NATO would use the Greenland-Iceland-United Kingdom Sosus barrier as a huge tripwire, a burglar alarm system. Allied submarines and ASW patrol aircraft would try to seek out, attack, and destroy Soviet submarines as they approached it, before they could cross the lines. The barrier had never been expected to halt more than half of the attacking submarines, however, and those that succeeded in slipping through would have to be handled differently. The deep ocean basins were simply too wide and too deep. The average depth was over 2 miles, to be littered with sensors as the shallow choke points were. This was a fact that cut both ways. The NATO mission would be to maintain the Atlantic Bridge and continue transoceanic trade, and the obvious Soviet mission would be to interdict this trade. Submarines would have to spread out over the vast ocean to cover the many possible convoy routes. NATO strategy behind the Sosus barriers, then, was to assemble large convoys, each ringed with destroyers, helicopters, and fixed-wing aircraft. The escorts would try to establish a protective bubble about 100 miles across. Enemy submarines would not be able to exist within that bubble. If in it, they would be hunted down and killed, or merely driven off long enough for the convoy to speed past. Thus, while Sosus was designed to neutralize a huge, fixed expanse of sea, Deep Basin strategy was founded on mobility, a moving zone of protection for the vital North Atlantic shipping. This was an altogether sensible strategy, but one that could not be tested under realistic conditions, and, unfortunately, one that was largely useless at the moment. With all the Soviet Alphas and Victors already on the coast, and the last of the Charlies, Echoes, and Novembers just arriving on their stations, the master screen Commander Quentin was staring at was no longer filled with discrete little red dots, but rather with large circles. Each dot or circle designated the position of a Soviet submarine. A circle represented an estimated position, calculated from the speed with which a sub could move without giving off enough noise to be localized by the many sensors being employed. some circles were 10 miles across, some as much as 50. An area anywhere from 78 to 2,000 square miles had to be searched if the submarine were again to be pinned down. And there were just too damn many of the boats. Hunting the submarines was principally the job of the P-3C Orion. Each Orion carried sonoboys, air-deployable active and passive sonar sets that were dropped from the belly of the aircraft. On detecting something, a sonoboy reported to its mother aircraft and then automatically sank lest it fall into unfriendly hands. The sonoboys had limited electrical power and thus limited range. Worse, their supply was finite. The sonoboy inventory was already being depleted alarmingly, and soon they would have to cut back on expenditures. Additionally, each P-3C carried FLIRs, forward-looking infrared scanners, to identify the heat signature of a nuclear sub, and MADs, magnetic anomaly detectors, that located the disturbance in the Earth's magnetic field caused by a large chunk of ferrous metal, like a submarine. Mad Gear could only detect a magnetic disturbance 600 yards to the left and right of an aircraft's course track, and to do this, the aircraft had to fly low, consuming fuel and limiting the crew's visual search range. FLIR had roughly the same limitation. Thus, the technology used to localize a target first detected by SOSUS, or to delouse, a discrete piece of ocean, preparatory to the passage of a convoy, simply was not up to a random search of the deep ocean. Quentin leaned forward. A circle had just changed to a dot. A P-3C had just dropped an explosive-sounding charge and localized an Echo-class attack sub 500 miles south of the Grand Banks. For an hour, they had a near-certain shooting solution on that Echo. Her name was written on the Orion's Mark 46 ASW torpedoes. Quentin sipped at his coffee. His stomach rebelled at the additional caffeine, remembering the abuse of 4 months of hellish chemotherapy. If there was to be a war, this was one way it might start. All at once, their submarines would stop, perhaps just like this, not sneaking to kill convoys in mid-ocean, but attacking them closer to shore, the way the Germans had done. And all the American sensors would be in the wrong place. Once stopped, the dots would grow to circles, ever wider, making the task of finding the subs all the more difficult. Their engines quiet, the boats would be invisible traps for the passing merchant vessels and warships racing to bring life-saving supplies to the men in Europe. Submarines were like cancer, just like the disease that he had only barely defeated. The invisible, malignant vessels would find a place, stop to infect it, and on his screen, the malignancies would grow until they were attacked by the aircraft he controlled from this room. But he could not attack them now. Only watch. PKEST, 1 hour. Run, he typed into his computer console. 23, the computer answered at once. Quentin grunted. 24 hours earlier, the PK, probability of a kill, had been 40. 40 probable kills in the first hour after getting a shooting authorization. Now, it was barely half that, and this number had to be taken with a large grain of salt, since it assumed that everything would work, a happy state of affairs found only in fiction. Soon, he judged, the number would be under 10. This did not include kills from friendly submarines that were trailing the Russians under strict orders not to reveal their positions. His sometime allies in the Sturgeons, Permits, and Los Angeleses were playing their own ASW game by their own set of rules, a different breed. He tried to think of them as friends, but it never quite worked. In his 20 years of naval service, submarines had always been the enemy. In war, they would be useful enemies, but in a war, it was widely recognized that there was no such thing as a friendly submarine. A B-52. The bomber crew knew exactly where the Russians were. Navy Orions and the Air Force Sentries had been shadowing them for days now, and the day before, he'd been told, the Soviets had sent an armed fighter from the Kiev to the nearest sentry. Possibly an attack mission. Probably not. It had, in any case, been a provocation. 4 hours earlier, the squadron of 14 had flown out of Plattsburgh, New York, at 0330, leaving behind black trails of exhaust smoke hidden in the pre-dawn gloom. Each aircraft carried a full load of fuel and 12 missiles whose total weight was far less than the 52's design bomb load. This made for good, long range, which was exactly what they needed. Knowing where the Russians were was only half the battle. Hitting them was the other. The mission profile was simple in concept, rather more difficult in execution. As had been learned in missions over Hanoi, in which the B-52 had participated and sustained SAM, surface-to-air missile, damage, the best method of attacking a heavily defended target was to converge from all points of the compass at once, like the enveloping arms of an angry bear, the squadron commander had put it at the briefing, indulging his poetic nature. This gave half the squadron relatively direct courses to their target. The other half had to curve around, careful to keep well beyond the effective radar coverage. All had to turn exactly on cue. The B-52s had turned 10 minutes earlier, on command from the sentry quarterbacking the mission. The pilot had added a twist. His course to the Soviet formation took his bomber right down a commercial air route. On making his turn, he had switched his IFF transponder from its normal setting to international. He was 50 miles behind a commercial 747, 30 miles ahead of another, and on Soviet radar, all three Boeing products would look exactly alike. Harmless. It was still dark down on the surface. There was no indication that the Russians were alerted yet. Their fighters were only supposed to be VFR, visual flight rules, capable, and the pilot imagined that taking off and landing on a carrier in the dark was a pretty risky business, doubly so in bad weather. "Skipper," the electronic warfare officer called on the intercom, "we're getting L and S-band emissions. They're right where they're supposed to be."
"Roger. Enough for a return off us?"
"That's a firm. But they'll probably think we're flying Pan Am. No fire control stuff yet, just routine air search."
"Range to target?"
130 miles. It was almost time. The mission profile was such that all would hit the 125-mile circle at the same moment.
"Everything ready?"
"That's a roger." The pilot relaxed for another minute, waiting for the signal from the entry. "Flashlight, flashlight, flashlight." The signal came over the digital radio channel.
"That's it. Let 'em know we're here," the aircraft commander ordered.
"Right." The electronic warfare officer flipped the clear plastic cover off his set of toggle switches and dials controlling the aircraft's jamming systems. First, he powered up his systems. This took a few seconds. The 52's electronics were all old 70s vintage equipment, else the squadron would not be part of the junior varsity. Good learning tools, though. And the lieutenant was hoping to move up to the new B-1Bs now beginning to come off the Rockwell assembly line in California. For the past 10 minutes, the ESM pods on the bomber's nose and wingtips had been recording the Soviet radar signals, classifying their exact frequencies, pulse repetition rates, power, and the individual signature characteristics of the transmitters. The lieutenant was brand new to this game. He was a recent graduate of electronic warfare school, first in his class. He considered what he should do first, then selected a jamming mode, not his best, from a range of memorized options. The Nikolaev. 125 miles away, on the Kara-class cruiser, Nikolaev, a radar Mishman, was examining some blips that seemed to be in a circle around his formation. In an instant, his screen was covered with 20 ghostly splotches, tracing crazily in various directions. He shouted the alarm, echoed a second later by a brother operator. The officer of the watch hurried over to check the screen. By the time he got there, the jamming mode had changed, and 6 lines, like the spokes of a wheel, were rotating slowly around a central axis. "Plot the strobes," the officer ordered. Now there were blotches, lines, and sparkles.
"More than one aircraft, comrade," the Mishman tried, flipping through his frequency settings. "A deck warning," another Mishman shouted. His ESM receiver had just reported the signals of aircraft search radar sets of the type used to acquire targets for air-to-surface missiles. The B-52.
We got hard targets, the weapons officer on the 52 reported. I got a lock on the first three birds.
Roger that, the pilot acknowledged. Hold for 10 more seconds.
10 seconds, the officer replied.
Cutting switches.
Now.
Okay, kill the jamming.
ECM systems off.
The Nikolaev.
Missile acquisition radars have ceased, the Combat Information Center officer reported to the cruiser's captain, just now arrived from the bridge. Around them, the Nikolaev's crew was racing to battle stations.
Jamming has also ceased.
What is out there? The captain asked. Out of a clear sky, his beautiful clipper-bowed cruiser had been threatened. And now all was well?
At least 8 enemy aircraft encircle around us.
The captain examined the now-normal S-band air search screen. There were numerous blips, mainly civilian aircraft. The half-circle of others had to be hostile, though.
Could they have fired missiles?
No, comrade captain. We would have detected it.
They jammed our search radars for 30 seconds and illuminated us with their own search systems for 20. Then everything stopped.
So, they provoke us and now pretend nothing has happened, the captain growled.
When will they be within SAM range?
This one and these two will be within our range in 4 minutes if they do not change course.
Illuminate them with our missile control systems. Teach the bastards a lesson.
The officer gave the necessary instructions, wondering who was being taught what. 2,000 feet above, one of the B-52s was an EC-135, whose computerized electronic sensors were recording all signals from the Soviet cruiser and taking them apart, the better to know how to jam them. It was the first good look at the new SAN-8 missile system.
2 F-14 Tomcats. The 00 code number on its fuselage marked the Tomcat as the squadron commander's personal bird. The black ace of spades on the twin rudder tail indicated his squadron, Fighting 41, the Black Aces. The pilot was Commander Robbie Jackson, and his radio call sign was Spade 1. Jackson was leading a two-plane section under the direction of one of the Kennedys' E-2C Hawkeyes, the Navy's more diminutive version of the Air Force's AWACS, and close brother to the COD, a twin-prop aircraft whose radome makes it look like an airplane being terrorized by a UFO. The weather was bad, depressingly normal for the North Atlantic in December, but was supposed to improve as they headed west. Jackson and his wingman, Lieutenant J.G. Bud Sanchez, were flying through the nearly solid clouds, and they had eased their formation out somewhat. In the limited visibility, both remembered that each Tomcat had a crew of two and a price of over $30 million. They were doing what the Tomcat does best, an all-weather interceptor. The F-14 has transoceanic range, Mach 2 speed, and a radar computer fire control system that can lock onto and attack 6 separate targets with long-range Phoenix air-to-air missiles. Each fighter was now carrying 2 of those, along with a pair each of AIM-9M Sidewinder heatseekers. Their prey was a flight of YAK-36 Forgers, the bastard VSTOL fighters that operated from the carrier Kiev. After harassing the sentry the previous day, Ivan had decided to close with the Kennedy force, no doubt guided in with data from a reconnaissance satellite. The Soviet aircraft had come up short, their range being 50 miles less than they needed to sight the Kennedy. Washington decided that Ivan was getting a little too obnoxious on this side of the ocean. Admiral Painter had been given permission to return the favor, in a friendly sort of way. Jackson figured that he and Sanchez could handle this, even outnumbered. No Soviet aircraft, least of all the Forger, was equal to the Tomcat. Certainly not while I'm flying it, Jackson thought.
Spade 1, your target is near 12 o'clock and level. Distance now 20 miles, reported the voice of Hummer 1, the Hawkeye, 100 miles aft.
Jackson did not acknowledge.
Got anything, Chris? He asked his radar intercept officer, Lieutenant Commander Christensen.
An occasional flash, but nothing I can use.
They were tracking the Forgers with passive systems only, in this case, an infrared sensor. Jackson considered illuminating their targets with his powerful fire control radar. The Forger's ESM pods would sense this at once, reporting to their pilots that their death warrant had been written, but not yet signed.
How about Kiev?
Nothing. The Kiev group is under total MCON.
Cute,
Jackson commented. He guessed that the SAC raid on the Kirov-Nikolaev group had taught them to be more careful. It was not generally known that warships often made no use whatever of their radar system, a protective measure called MCON, for emission control. The reason was that a radar beam could be detected at several times the distance at which it generated a return signal to its transmitter, and could thus tell an enemy more than it told its operators.
You suppose these guys find their way home without help?
If they don't, you know who's going to get blamed, Christensen chuckled.
That's a roger, Jackson agreed.
Okay, I got infrared acquisition. Clouds must be thinning out some. Christensen was concentrating on his instruments, oblivious of the view out of the canopy.
Spade 1, this is Hummer 1. Your target is 12 o'clock. At your level, range now 10 miles,
the report came over the secure radio circuit.
Not bad. Picking up the Forger's heat signature through this slop, Jackson thought, especially since they had small, inefficient engines.
Radar coming on, Skipper, Christensen advised. Kiev has an S-band air search just come on. They have us for sure.
Right, Jackson thumbed his mic switch. Spade 2, illuminate targets. Now.
Roger, lead, Sanchez acknowledged. No point hiding now. Both fighters activated their powerful ANAWG-9 radars. It was now 2 minutes to intercept. The radar signals received by the ESM threat receivers on the Forger's tail fins set off a musical tone in the pilot headsets, which had to be turned off manually, and lit up a red warning light on each control panel.
The Kingfisher Flight.
Kingfisher Flight, this is Kiev, called the carrier's air operations officer. We show two American fighters closing in on you at high speed from the rear.
Acknowledged. The Russian flight leader checked his mirror. He'd hoped to avoid this, though he hadn't expected to. His orders were to take no action unless fired upon. They had just broken into the clear. Too bad. He'd have felt safer in the clouds. The pilot of Kingfisher 3, Lieutenant Shavrov, reached down to arm his four atolls. Not this time, Yankee, he thought.
The Tomcats.
1 minute, Spade 1. You ought to have visual any time, Hummer 1 called in.
Roger.
Tally-ho!
Jackson and Sanchez broke into the clear. The Forgers were a few miles ahead, and the Tomcat's 250-knot speed advantage was eating that distance up rapidly. The Russian pilots are keeping a nice tight formation, Jackson thought, but anybody can drive a bus.
Spade 2. Let's go to burners on my mark. 3, 2, 1, mark!
Both pilots advanced their engine controls and engaged their afterburners, which dumped raw fuel into the tailpipes of their new F-110 engines. The fighters leapt forward with a sudden double thrust and went quickly through Mach 1.
The Kingfisher Flight.
Kingfisher, warning, warning! The Americans have increased speed,
Kiev cautioned.
Kingfisher 4 turned in his seat. He saw the Tomcats a mile aft, twin dart-like shapes racing before trails of black smoke. Sunlight glinted off one canopy, and it almost looked like the flashes of a...
They're attacking!
What? The flight leader checked his mirror again.
Negative! Negative! Hold formation!
The Tomcats screeched 50 feet overhead, the sonic booms they trailed sounding just like explosions. Shavrov acted entirely on his combat-trained instincts. He jerked back on his stick and triggered his four missiles at the departing American fighters.
Three, what did you do?
The Russian flight leader demanded.
They were attacking us, didn't you hear? Shavrov protested.
The Tomcats.
Oh, shit, Spade Flight, you have four atolls after you, the voice of the Hawkeye's controller said.
Two, break right, Jackson ordered.
Chris, activate countermeasures.
Jackson threw his fighter into a violent, evasive turn to the left. Sanchez broke the other way. In the seat behind Jackson's, the radar intercept officer flipped switches to activate the aircraft's defense systems. As the Tomcat twisted in midair, a series of flares and balloons were ejected from the tail section, each an infrared or radar lure for the pursuing missiles. All four were targeted on Jackson's fighter.
Spade 2 is clear. Spade 2 is clear. Spade 1, you still have four birds in pursuit, the voice from the Hawkeye said.
Roger. Jackson was surprised at how calmly he took it. The Tomcat was doing over 800 miles per hour and accelerating. He wondered how much range the atoll had. His rearward-looking radar warning light flicked on.
Two, get after him, Jackson ordered.
Roger, lead. Sanchez swept into a climbing turn, fell off into a hammerhead, and dived at the retreating Soviet fighters. When Jackson turned, two of the missiles lost lock and kept going straight into open air. A third, decoyed into hitting a flare, exploded harmlessly. The fourth kept its infrared seeker head on Spade 1's glowing tailpipes and bored right in. The missile struck the Spade 1 at the base of its starboard rudder fin. The impact tossed the fighter completely out of control. Most of the explosive force was spent as the missile blasted through the boron surface into open air. The fin was blown completely off, along with the right side stabilizer. The left fin was badly holed by fragments, which smashed through the back of the fighter's canopy, hitting Christensen's helmet. The right engine's fire warning lights came on at once. Jackson heard the oomph over his intercom. He killed every engine switch on the right side and activated the in-frame fire extinguisher. Next, he chopped power to his port engine, still on afterburner. By this time, the Tomcat was in an inverted spin. The variable geometry wings angled out to low-speed configuration. This gave Jackson aileron control, and he worked quickly to get back to normal attitude. His altitude was 4,000 feet. There wasn't much time.
"Okay, baby," he coaxed.
A quick burst of power gave him back aerodynamic control, and the former test pilot snapped his fighter over. Too hard. It went through two complete rolls before he could catch it in level flight.
"Gotcha! You with me, Chris?"
Nothing. There was no way he could look around, and there were still four hostile fighters behind him.
"Spade 2, this is lead."
"Roger, lead." Sanchez had the four forgers boresighted. They had just fired at his commander. Hummer 1. On Hummer 1, the controller was thinking fast. The forgers were holding formation, and there was a lot of Russian chatter on the radio circuit.
"Spade 2, this is Hummer 1. Break off. I say again, break off. Do not. Repeat. Do not fire. Acknowledge. Spade 2. Spade 1 is at your 9 o'clock, 2,000 feet below you."
The officer swore and looked at one of the enlisted men he worked with.
"That was too fast, sir. Just too fucking fast. We got tapes of the Ruskies. I can't understand it, but it sounds like Kiev is right pissed."
"They're not the only ones," the controller said, wondering if he had done the right thing calling Spade 2 off. It sure as hell didn't feel that way. The Tomcats. Sanchez's head jerked in surprise.
"Roger, breaking off."
His thumb came off the switch.
"God damn it!"
He pulled his stick back, throwing the Tomcat into a savage loop.
"Where are you, lead?"
Sanchez brought his fighter under Jackson's and did a slow circle to survey the visible damage.
"Fire's out, Skipper. Right side rudder and stabilizer are gone. Left side fin... shit, I can see through it. But it looks like it ought to hold together. Wait a minute. Chris is slumped over. Skipper, can you talk to him?"
"Negative. I've tried. Let's go back home."
Nothing would have pleased Sanchez more than to blast the forgers right out of the sky, and with his four missiles, he could have done this easily. But like most pilots, he was highly disciplined.
"Roger, lead."
"Spade 1, this is Hummer 1. Advise your condition. Over."
"Hummer 1, we'll make it unless something else falls off. Tell them to have Doc standing by. Chris is hurt. I don't know how bad."
It took an hour to get to the Kennedy. Jackson's fighter flew badly. Would not hold course in any specific attitude. He had to adjust trim constantly. Sanchez reported some movement in the aft cockpit. Maybe it was just the intercom shot out, Jackson thought hopefully. Sanchez was ordered to land first, so that the deck would be cleared for Commander Jackson. On the final approach, the Tomcat started to handle badly. The pilot struggled with his fighter, planting it hard on the deck and catching the number one wire. The right side landing gear collapsed at once, and the $30 million fighter slid sideways into the barrier that had been erected. 100 men with firefighting gear raced towards it from all directions. The canopy went up on emergency hydraulic power. After unbuckling himself, Jackson fought his way around and tried to grab for his backseater. They had been friends for many years. Chris was alive. It looked like a quart of blood had poured down the front of his flight suit, and when the first orderly took the helmet off, he saw that it was still pumping out. The second orderly corpsman pushed Jackson out of the way and attached a cervical collar to the wounded airman. Christensen was lifted gently and lowered onto a stretcher, whose bearers ran towards the island. Jackson hesitated a moment before following it. Norfolk Naval Medical Center. Captain Randall Tate, of the Navy Medical Corps, walked down the corridor to meet the Russians. He looked younger than his 45 years, because his full head of black hair showed not the first sign of gray. Tate was a Mormon, educated at Brigham Young University and Stanford Medical School, who had joined the Navy because he had wanted to see more of the world than one could from an office at the foot of the Wasatch Mountains. He had accomplished that much, and until today he had also avoided anything resembling diplomatic duty. As the new chief at the Department of Medicine at Bethesda Naval Medical Center, he knew that couldn't last. He had flown down to Norfolk only a few hours earlier to handle the case. The Russians had driven down and taken their time doing it. "Good morning, gentlemen. I'm Dr. Tate." They shook hands all around, and the lieutenant who had brought them up walked back to the elevator. "Dr. Ivanov," the shortest one said, "I am physician to the embassy." Captain Smirnov, Tate knew him to be assistant naval attaché, a career intelligence officer. The doctor had been briefed on the helicopter trip down by a Pentagon intelligence officer who was now drinking coffee in the hospital commissary. "Vasily Pechkin, doctor. I am second secretary to the embassy." This one was a senior KGB officer, a legal spy with a diplomatic cover. "May we see our men?" "Certainly. Will you follow me, please?" Tate led them back down the corridor. He'd been on the go for 20 hours. This was part of the territory as chief of service at Bethesda. He got all the hard calls. One of the first things a doctor learns is how not to sleep. The whole floor was set up for intensive care, Norfolk Naval Medical Center having been built with war casualties in mind. Intensive care unit number 3 was a room 25 feet square. The only windows were on the corridor wall, and the curtains had been drawn back. There were 4 beds, only one occupied. The young man in it was almost totally concealed. The only thing not hidden by the oxygen mask covering his face was an unruly clump of wheat-colored hair. The rest of his body was fully draped. An IV stand was next to the bed, its 2 bottles of fluid merging in a single line that led under the covers. A nurse, dressed like Tate in surgical greens, was standing at the foot of the bed, her green eyes locked on the electrocardiograph readout over the patient's head, dropping momentarily to make a notation on his chart. On the far side of the bed was a machine whose function was not immediately obvious. The patient was unconscious.
"His condition?" Ivanov asked.
"Critical," Tate replied. "It's a miracle he got here alive at all. He was in the water for at least 12 hours, probably more like 20. Even accounting for the fact that he was wearing a rubber exposure suit, given the ambient air and water temperatures, there's just no way he ought to have been alive. On admission, his core temperature was 23.8 degrees Celsius. Tate shook his head. "I've read about worse hypothermia cases in the literature, but this is by far the worst I've ever seen."
"Prognosis?" Ivanov looked into the room.
Tate shrugged. "Hard to say. Maybe as good as 50-50. Maybe not. He's still extremely shocked. He's a fundamentally healthy person. You can't see it from here, but he's in superb physical shape, like a track and field man. He has a particularly strong heart. That's probably what kept him alive long enough to get here. We have the hypothermia pretty much under control now. The problem is, with hypothermia, so many things go wrong at once.
We have to fight a number of separate but connected battles against different systemic enemies to keep them from overwhelming his natural defenses. If anything's going to kill him, it'll be the shock. We're treating that with electrolytes. The normal routine. But he's going to be on the edge for several days at least. Tate looked up. Another man was pacing down the hall. Younger than Tate, and taller. He had a white lab coat over his greens. He carried a metal chart.
"Gentlemen, this is Dr. Lieutenant Jameson. He's the physician of record on the case. He admitted your man. What do you have, Jamie?"
The sputum sample showed pneumonia. Bad news. Worse, his blood chemistry isn't getting any better, and his white count is dropping. "Great." Tate leaned against the window frame and swore to himself. "Here's the printout from the blood analyzer." Jameson handed the chart over.
"May I see this, please?"
Ivanov came around.
"Sure."
Tate flipped the metal cloud chart open and held it so that everyone could see it. Ivanov had never worked with a computerized blood analyzer, and it took several seconds for him to orient himself.
"This is not good."
"Not at all," Tate agreed.
"We're going to have to jump on that pneumonia hard," Jameson said. "This kid's got too many things going wrong. If the pneumonia really takes hold..." He shook his head.
"Keflin?" Tate asked.
"Yeah." Jameson pulled the vial from his pocket. "As much as he'll handle. I'm guessing that he had a mild case before he got dumped in the water, and I hear that some penicillin-resistant strains have been cropping up in Russia. You use mostly penicillin over there, right?" Jameson looked down at Ivanov.
"Correct. What is this Keflin?"
"It's a big gun. A synthetic antibiotic. And it works well on resistant strains." "Right now, Jamie," Tate ordered. Jameson walked around the corner to enter the room. He injected the antibiotic into a 100cc piggyback IV bottle and hung it on a stand.
"He's so young," Ivanov noted. "He treated our man initially?"
"His name's Albert Jameson. We call him Jamie. He's 29, graduated Harvard third in his class, and he's been with us ever since. He's board certified in internal medicine and virology. He's as good as they come." Tate suddenly realized how uncomfortable he was dealing with the Russians. His education and years of naval service taught him that these men were the enemy. That didn't matter. Years before, he had sworn an oath to treat patients without regard to outside considerations. Would they believe this, or did they think he'd let their man die because he was a Russian?
"Gentlemen, I want you to understand this. We're giving your man the very best care we can. We're not holding anything back. If there's a way to give him back to you alive, we'll find it. But I can't make any promises."
The Soviets could see that. While waiting for instructions from Moscow, Pechkin had checked up on Tate and found him to be, though a religious fanatic, an efficient and honorable physician, one of the best in government service.
"Has he said anything?" Pechkin asked casually.
"Not since I've been here. Jamie said that right after they started warming him up, he was semi-conscious and babbled for a few minutes. We taped it, of course, and had a Russian-speaking officer listen to it. Something about a girl with brown eyes didn't make any sense. Probably his sweetheart. He's a good-looking kid. He probably has a girl at home. It was totally incoherent, though. A patient in his condition has no idea what's going on."
"Can we listen to the tape?"
Pechkin said.
"Certainly. I'll have it sent up."
Jameson came around the corner. "Done. A gram of Keflin every 6 hours. Hope it works."
"How about his hands and feet?" Smirnov asked.
The captain knew something about frostbite. "We're not even bothering with that," Jameson answered. "We have cotton around the digits to prevent maceration. If he survives the next few days, we'll get blebs and maybe have some tissue loss, but that's the least of our problems."
"You guys know what his name is?"
Pechkin's head snapped around. "He wasn't wearing any dog tags when he arrived. His clothes didn't have the ship's name, no wallet, no identification, not even any coins in his pocket. It doesn't matter very much for his initial treatment, but I'd feel better if you could pull his medical records. It would be good to know if he had any allergies or underlying medical conditions. We don't want him to go into shock from an allergic reaction to drug treatment."
"What was he wearing?"
Smirnov asked. "A rubber exposure suit," Jameson answered.
The guys who found him left it on him, thank God. I cut it off him when he arrived. Under that, shirt, pants, handkerchief. Don't your guys wear dog tags?
Yes, Smirnov responded.